red light's on already? Just kidding, just kidding. My name's Bob Bell, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm sober today only through the grace of God and the people and programs of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to thank Maryland for inviting me down here to share with you. And I'd like to thank all the people in this group that are of service. This is an incredible group. If I lived in Los Angeles, this would be my home group. I like the enthusiasm here. There's something here that's real special. And I'd like to thank Clancy for starting this group. And besides, Marilyn told me that if I said something nice about him, mentioned his name, he'd make all the people he sponsored buy the tape and listen to that part over and over and over again. And I'd really like to welcome anybody who's reasonably new. I'm real glad you're here. I really want to welcome you if you're here and you know you have a problem with alcohol, but you got so many other problems that you know that Alcoholics Anonymous can't possibly be what you need. Because I came here like that. There's one thing that we seem to all have in common, and it talks about it in the beginning of chapter 3 of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. It says, most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. There's something about this disease that doesn't want me to be one of you. And that's why for guys like me and for a lot of us, this is the last place we come. We try a lot of weird stuff before we get here. Primal screaming and transcendental meditation. And I've been everything from Ram Dass to Rum Dum. And I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous, the last place I wanted to come to. And I had a lot of things to confuse the issue for me. I also did a lot of drugs, and so I could use that to say, well, I'm not quite like you people, or there's something, I'm different, I know I have a drinking problem, and I might be an alcoholic, but I'm a special kind of alcoholic. Not quite like you people. I was the kind of guy that I drank almost every day, and if I came over to your house and I'd go and use your bathroom and lock the door, and I'd go through your medicine cabinet and take whatever's there. I didn't know what it was. Sometimes I'd go up, sometimes I'd go down, sometimes I'd get real regular. once in a while I'd find one of those wheels and that women keep, and you take all the pills on one of those, it doesn't get you high, but you have this overwhelming urge to nurse someone, you know. Come here, Rocco! And because of that, I was able to sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and tell myself that I was different. And I'm a real alcoholic. I was the real alcoholic all along. Alcoholism is the only disease I know of that uses the person who has the disease, his own mind, against them. If there was another name for this disease, it would be I'm the not quite like you disease, or I'm a little bit different. And I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was just a kid. I was in an institution. It was 1971. I didn't want to be there. I didn't relate to anybody. I didn't hear anything. My defense mechanisms were so strong that nothing you said could get in. All I could do was sit there and judge you. And that way I didn't have to listen to you. And from 1971 to 1978, I was in and out of institutions, and I was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's a tough way to go. And I remember sitting in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and really feeling like I didn't fit. I don't think I knew what an alcoholic was. In Chapter 3, it says that we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were real alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. And one of my problems is that I live in between my ears most of the time, so nothing ever gets to my innermost self. So I could go through a spin dry, or I could go through a group, a P&P group. That's probation and parole, I think it's something else. or and sit there and talk about alcoholism, and I could intellectually understand that I'm probably an alcoholic and I could talk about it, but it never really got down here. And I really didn't think I knew what an alcoholic was. I thought it had something to do with drinking or having a drinking problem, and that was it. And I had to learn from listening to you people and looking at my own experience that I was like you, I was one of you. I would hear people in Alcoholics Anonymous in the years I was in and out talk about this disease and talk about what Silkworth talks about in the book. Silkworth says that we are people who have an allergy to alcohol. And the allergy manifests itself in a phenomenon of craving. And I never considered myself to have a craving for alcohol. I knew I got drunk every time I drank, but that was the way I drank. And I was sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I heard a woman share something that was part of her experience, and a light went on. And I remembered something that had happened to me. I was about 19 years old, and I was dating this gal, and her parents invited me over for dinner. Now, it's one of those evenings where you meet the family. You know, I don't do well in those kind of situations. You know, I don't feel comfortable. I'm sitting there at the dinner table, and they had a bottle of wine. And I drink quickly. I think evaporation must have been an issue with me. I'm not sure. But because I drink quickly, I got two glasses of wine out of that bottle, and I'm done the second glass, and they're just still sipping on their first one. And I finished the second glass, and the bottle's empty, and I'm getting a little nervous. And I said to him, that was really good wine. Do you have any more of that? They said, no. Okay. Now I'm sitting there, and I'm getting a little more uncomfortable, and I blurted out, you know, I really like beer. And they said, well, that's nice. We don't have any beer. Now I'm getting really uncomfortable. And finally I said, I enjoy a cocktail with dinner. And they said, well, we don't have any cocktails. And I was embarrassed. And I sat there. Now I know I'm stuck there for a couple more hours. And I had two glasses of wine in me. And they're yammering on about Vietnam and the sports and the crops and Aunt Emma and Uncle Jake and all this stuff, you know. And I'm going crazy. I want to scream at them to shut up. And I don't know what to do. My head's going a million miles an hour. I feel like I want to scream. So I excused myself, and I went to the bathroom, and I locked myself in the bathroom. And like an animal, I went through the cupboards and cabinets until I found a bottle of cough medicine. It had enough alcohol and codeine and other stuff in it. I sat down on the edge of the tub, and I chugged that down so I could chill out and think. So I could come up with an excuse about something that I had to go take care of. And I was able to go out there and explain to them the importance of this thing I'd forgotten about. And I was very gracious, and they were very understanding. And I was able to leave there and go to a friend of mine's house who had a bar in his basement to finish the deal. And I was the only one at that dinner table that was an alcoholic. If any of those other people would have been alcoholics, we'd all been in that goddamn bathroom rummaging through those cabins. And that's the phenomenon of craving. And Silkworth says that guys like me are different from other people. And what differentiates me from every other kind of wacko out in the world is that I have this phenomenon of craving. I'm physically different than other people. And that waits for me if I'm sober 50 years or 5 years or 25 years. If I take a drink, that allergy waits for me. And I don't think I really got that and really understood how different I was until I was about 4 years sober. And I was dating this gal who wasn't an alcoholic, and we'd go out to dinner and she'd order a drink, and I swear to God it would take her a half hour to drink it. It would just drive me crazy. The ice would be melting, and then she'd order a second drink and she'd drink about half of it. And she'd say the most bizarre thing I've ever heard. She'd push it aside and say, I don't want any more. I'm starting to feel it. Now, it would be easier for me as an alcoholic to have sex and after two strokes say, I don't want any more. I'm starting to feel it. Than it would be to do that with two drinks. And I started to get it, that really, I am different. When she takes two drinks of alcohol, she gets a feeling like she's losing control. I take two drinks of alcohol, I get a feeling like I'm getting control. And every drink of alcohol I've ever taken in my whole life has made me feel one way. It's made me feel like I'd like to have another drink of alcohol. And that's the phenomenon of craving. And I have that till the day I die. Normies don't have that. Now, if that was the whole deal, then in 1971, in an institution, when they told me that I was one of those kind of guys that shouldn't drink and do drugs, I just wouldn't have done it anymore. But there's another part of this disease, and it was the part that almost killed me. And it was the part that was so baffling to me. Silkworth makes a statement. He says that guys like me, when I'm dry, I'm restless, irritable, and discontented. Unless I can again experience that sense of ease and comfort I'd once found in taking a few drinks. So for me, my alcoholism starts where the bottle and the bag ends. And it's the emptiness of sobriety that drives a guy like me back to picking up something that I know is going to destroy me. And one of the crazy things for me in Alcoholics Anonymous is I would go to meetings back on the East Coast, and I'd go to speaker meetings, and I would get a message from Alcoholics Anonymous that the people in AA stopped drinking and they got happy and grateful and all this other stuff. And I stopped drinking and I didn't get happy and grateful. I stopped drinking and for a little while I would impress people around me with the fact that I've turned over a new leaf. But what would happen to me is an emptiness would start to seep into me. It was like a hole. And I wouldn't understand what's happening, but sobriety would start to feel like I was doing time. Right? And if you've ever sat in a county jail waiting to get out, you know what it feels like to do time. And that's what sobriety... You know, I love W.C. Fields. He said, I was sober one time. It was the most boring 45 minutes of my life. Now, I can understand that. Because I quit drinking and there's something else wrong with me and I don't know what it is. And I go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and I don't hear anything. I see these idiots, you know, that they get up to the podium and they talk about a year ago I was living in the dumpster behind the Alano Club and through the grace of God and these wonderful 12 steps, I'm now the president of United States Steel or something like that. I tell you, there were meetings in Pittsburgh years in the early 70s. If I would have had an Uzi, the population of Alcoholics Anonymous would have been a lot smaller in Pittsburgh. I hated what you were because everything you were, everything that you are, pointed out in me in stark relief everything I wasn't. See, because I got to tell you, there were times between 71 and 78 where I really wanted to be sober. There were times when I was real sick of me, and I was real sick of being sick, and I was real sick of everything. And the problem is that I'd get sober. And eventually, what would happen is that I'd have no mental defense against my own emptiness. And eventually, I'd just get it up to here with being sober. And the most baffling part of that is that usually that would happen when my life is better than it's ever been. And that's what doesn't make any sense to me. See, I'd crawl out of the weeds, or I'd come out of, I'd end up in a county jail, or I'd come into some halfway house, and I've trashed my life once again completely, to nothing left. And in 5 or 6 months, I got a job, I got an apartment, I got an old used car, I got a girlfriend. From the outside looking in, and from the inside looking out at my life, it's better than it's ever been. Except that there's something wrong in here. And I don't know what it is. And I can't tell anybody about it because I don't know what to tell them. What am I going to tell them? They're going to say, what's wrong? Well, the problem is that there's nothing wrong. And I don't understand about untreated alcoholism. See, I'm a real alcoholic. I am incapable of staying dry with untreated alcoholism for sustained periods of time. I can't do it. And I've come to the conclusion, and this may offend some people, but I don't think everyone in Alcoholics Anonymous is an alcoholic. And the reason I come to that conclusion is because I see people in AA that come into Alcoholics Anonymous, they quit drinking, and they come to meetings for social reasons. They never have to sponsor anybody. They don't have to go back and make amends. They don't have to do any of that. They just quit drinking, and they're happy. And in the big book, it talks about that. It talks about the difference between a problem and hard drinker and the real alcoholic. And it talks, it says the hard drinker was sufficient reason if ill health, a relationship, losing a job, whatever becomes operative, he just swears off and never drinks again, and he doesn't. But the real alcoholic, we get to that point, we swear off and we drink again. And we swear off and we drink again. And we swear off and we drink again, and we hate ourselves a little more, and we keep doing it, and we don't know what the hell's happening. And we, and the problem with me is I'd come to meetings Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I'm a half-measures kind of guy, and I would sit there and I'd determine, okay, I'm not going to drink no more. And I'd look around, I'd find some idiot that goes to one meeting every other week that doesn't believe in the steps or service, and I'd go, that's what I need. Right? Because I come here with the minimum approach. It's like, okay, what's the bottom line? What's the most I absolutely have to do here? Right? Okay. And I just hope it's not too inconvenient. Right? And I die trying to imitate people in Alcoholics Anonymous that to this day I'm convinced aren't real alcoholics. Because if you got the same disease I got, and you don't throw yourself completely into this simple program, you're going to die of alcoholism. Now, that may not apply to everybody in this room, but that is the reality of my story. I tried for 7 years to do everything except the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I tried staying sober on the meetings. I tried staying sober on aftercare groups. I tried staying sober on all that stuff, and I couldn't do it. Finally, in 1978, I ended up in a detox hospital in Las Vegas, Nevada. And I ended up there because I was hitchhiking cross-country. I wanted to make it to California because I almost froze to death on the streets of Pittsburgh the winter before. I was homeless before it was chic to be homeless. There was nobody trying to raise money for me, let me tell you. And I ended up in Las Vegas, and I'm in this hospital, and something had happened to me. And they talk about it in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got to the place it talks about in there. It calls, in chapter 11, what I think of as the vestibule of Alcoholics Anonymous. They call it the jumping off place. And it says that we get to a place where we can't live with alcohol anymore, and we can't live without it. We will know a loneliness such as few do. And it's not that loneliness of because you lost your family and friends. It's that sick, sick kind of loneliness when you're sitting in a bar drinking shots and beers, and you're doing the only thing you've ever known that's allowed you to feel whole and allowed you to feel like you're somebody, and you still don't feel whole, and you still feel disconnected, and you sit there and you look down the bar and you look at the guys that are shooting pool and laughing and carrying on, and you wonder, what the heck's wrong with me? How come I'm not getting the effects out of this that they're getting? And I can remember when I did. See, for a lot of years, alcohol and combinations of drugs and alcohol was a treatment for the inside emptiness of alcoholism. And I've had the experience, and many of you had it, where you're working somewhere and you can't stand the job, you can't stand the people you work with, you go there and you feel so isolated, and you just, everybody stays away from you because you bristle with antagonism. And the buzzer rings and you check out and you run across the street to the local tavern, you have two double shots of Jack Daniels and two beers, and the people that you work with start coming in and you start realizing how nice people they are. And after a few more drinks, you're planning vacations together, you know? And at that point in my life, alcohol was an effective treatment for the dis-ease and discomfort of alcoholism. But the end of my drinking, it didn't work. It's not, now when I say, if you're new, when I say it didn't work, don't get me wrong, it's not that I couldn't get drunk. And it's not that I couldn't pass out. Matter of fact, passing out was all I had. What it didn't do is it no longer connected me with the world. It no longer relieved me of the bondage of self. It no longer allowed me to come out and play and be a part of. And it finally, it broke my heart. I read a story when I was new in sobriety. It wasn't AA literature or anything, but it told me a lot about what had happened to me. And the story was about these scientists who were doing experiments with laboratory rats. And they found that in the brain of a rat, just like in a person, is this little part that they called a pleasure center. And they discovered if they put two tiny wire filaments into that part of the rat's brain and passed a mild, undetectable electric charge through those wires, that the rat would get loaded. So what they did is they hooked up the juice to a pedal in the rat's cage, and the rat would learn he could hit that pedal and get high, so the rat would lay on the pedal. He wouldn't eat, he wouldn't sleep, you could trade lady rats in front of him, he'd say, leave me alone, I'm partying. And he'd lay on that pedal till he died. Now that's not what got me. What got me is that after the rat's been hitting that pedal for a while, these scientists cut the juice. Now this time the rat goes back and he hits the pedal, only this time nothing happens. And he hits it again and nothing happens, and he hits it again and nothing happens. And again, and again, and it finally sinks into his little rat brain that the party's over. So instead of being able to go back to being a rat, he curls up in a ball in his cage and lays there to die because there's nothing to live for. And that's the way I felt at the end of my run. When I knew that the party's over, I felt like that poor rat. Because all I really wanted the last couple years of my drinking, I just wanted somebody to turn the juice on. That's all I wanted. I was paying the price for drinking and I wasn't getting the juice. And if you're new, I'm going to tell you something you may not believe. Alcoholics Anonymous turns the juice on. It restores that thing in me that makes me excited about life and enthusiastic about what's going on in this world, where I am out of myself and concerned with stuff out here and people out here. That Alcoholics Anonymous for me over the last little over 15 years has been a treatment for the disease of alcoholism. But getting to the point where I was willing to buy the package was a hard deal for me. In 1978, I was in this detox hospital in Las Vegas, Nevada, and one of the women that worked there was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she stopped me one day in the hall and she said, you've been in and out of AA for a lot of years, you've been in a lot of detoxes and treatment centers, what's different now from all these other times? I said to her, well, I just did the third step. Now, I don't even know what the third step is, but it was an AA-sounding kind of thing to say, you know? And I had a feeling it would brighten up her day, and she did it. She kind of got a smile on her face, and then she stopped and she looked at me and she said, you mean you got together with another member of Alcoholics Anonymous, got down on your knees and said the prayer on page 63 of the big book? And I was going to say yes, but I knew if I said yes, she'd ask me who I did it with, and I'd be stuck, right? So I said, no, Judy, I just did it my way. And she looked at me with this funny kind of look, and she starts laughing, and I'm not sure what's funny, but I'm the only one in the room, right? And I got real uncomfortable, and if you're new, stay away from old-timers and Alcoholics Anonymous. They just ruin your day. My sponsor spent years thinking I was the funniest thing that ever walked on the face of the earth. He got more pleasure out of my problems than I could. It's just incredible. A couple days later, I'm in this hospital, and I'm going crazy because I'm about to get out of there, and I know the truth. And the truth is that I don't want to drink no more, but I'm gonna. And I really don't want to drink no more. I don't want to sober up no more. I don't want to come to somewhere and not know how I got there or what charges I'm facing. I don't want to go through this stuff anymore. And alcohol doesn't work for me anymore. And yet I can't stop. And I know I can't stop. And I know no matter how much I pump myself up, that I'm going to pick up a drink. I don't know if it's going to be the week I get out, the month later, 6 months, I don't know. But I know the truth. The truth is that I don't have what it takes to not drink. And the one thing that made me feel so different from you is that I assumed that you people, for some reason, had what it takes to not drink. And if you're new, please hear this. It never occurred to me that what Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who do not have what it takes to stay away from a drink. I was sitting in Alcoholics Anonymous comparing my untreated alcoholism to the outward manifestation of the program of recovery in your life, and I was coming up a loser. I could come up nothing else. And I'm sitting in this hospital room, and I'm desperate, and I'm scared, and I felt so hopeless. And I remember that this gal, Judy, had mentioned page 63 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I opened it up to page 63. In the middle of the page is this prayer. And it doesn't make a lot of sense because it's thee and thou and all that kind of stuff, right? And I started reading this prayer. Now, I'm amazed to this day that I did this because I came in here an atheist. And I got to the middle of that prayer, and there's a line there that says, relieve me of the bondage of self. And I read that line, and I threw that book across the room, and I started sobbing. And I said something from the bottom of my heart. I said, God, please, please help me. Because when I read that line, relieve me of the bondage of self, I knew that the reason my family wouldn't talk to me, and the reason that anybody who'd ever loved me couldn't be around me, and the reason that every job opportunity I ever had, I turned into crap, and the reason I was suicidal, and the reason I was going to probably drink again, was because of me. And I felt so hopeless because I don't know how to get away from me. I don't know how to be something different. I spent years in therapy in the early 70s, and I was sent there by my family trying to be somebody, trying to, if I could feel different, if I could be different, maybe I could live different. And I couldn't be different. I couldn't change me. I don't have the power to do that. And from the bottom of my heart, I said, God, please help me. And it was probably the first honest prayer I've ever said in my whole life. And I'm amazed because I didn't even believe in God. I was raised, I had a lot of religious upbringing when I was a kid, and it always intimidated me. And I went to Catholic school, and I always felt like there was something wrong with me, and I don't fit there, and I'm not good enough. And they used to tell me about all the things you're supposed to do and all the things you're not supposed to do, and even if you're good enough not to do the things you're not supposed to do, if you just think about doing them, you're screwed anyway, right? And I'm one of those kind of guys, you tell me not to think about something, that's all I think about. The nuns used to have a saying, you've got to be pure of thought, word, and deed. They'd say the word pure, and X-rated movies start going through my mind, right? And I don't want to think that stuff. And they told me about hell, and hell's a place where you go, and they burn you, and torture you, and it's awful, and you never get out, and it's just, oh, it's like ending up in Hoboken, New Jersey. It's just terrible. And they told me one day about a place called purgatory. And it's for guys like me who can't think right, don't feel right, never act right. And in purgatory, they burn you and torture you, and it's awful, but it only lasts for a couple hundred million years. That's supposed to give me hope. Now, I don't want to offend anybody, but I get to be about 13 years old, and I discover masturbation, and I can picture a meter in heaven kicking off the millions of years, right? And I haven't even done anything yet, I'm just practicing. So I developed a real attitude about God. And I was really on the muscle about it. And for years, coming in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, I could meet somebody I really liked. I remember one time I was on the inside, and these guys from AA came in from the outside, and one of the guys was a biker, and I really liked him, and he said a lot of neat stuff, and he's the kind of guy I could have drank with. He started talking about God, and I knew he's one of those people. It had happened to him. You know? Something like you one drink too many and it just burn out part of your brain or something, you know? You become saved. Right? So I had a real attitude about God. And for me, a little over 15 years ago in a hospital room, to get down on my knees and beg God from the bottom of my heart for help is a miracle. And that was my beginning. And shortly after that, a few days after that, I found myself in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I experienced my moment of commitment. And I think those of us that are here a long time, a lot of us have this moment of commitment. And I remember the moment real well. I was in a meeting, and I'm going crazy. And I'd been sober long enough to start to think clearly. Bad place. Living with my mind in early sobriety was like traveling cross country in a van full of 8-year-olds that have overdosed on sugar and none of them like you. Right? And I'm sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, now I'm sober several weeks, and I'm going crazy. My head is working me over, and this is the second thing I never did before. I grabbed the guy after the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. The guy had been sober a while, and I said, I got to talk to somebody. And I started to become vulnerable with this man. And you come from where I come from, you don't do that. You die rather than look weak. You never let anybody know that there's something wrong with you. And I sat down with this man at a table at the Alano Club, and I told him everything that was going on. I told him how scared I was. I told him I was afraid I was going to have to go two years in prison. That I didn't have a place to live. That I had emotional problems. I just didn't feel good, and something was wrong with me emotionally, and I was having these mood swings, and I don't know what's wrong with me. And I have mental problems. I can't read anything. They give me this 24-hour book, and I'd try to read a paragraph out of that, and I couldn't tell you 5 seconds later if my life would have depended on it, what was in that paragraph. It was like throwing it into a tornado. My head was so busy. And I got all these problems, and I don't think I can stay sober. I mean, why should I? I never did before. And I was kind of tired of trying. And this man listened to me, and when I was all done, he said, kid, he said, first of all, none of that stuff's any of your business. That was a novel idea. Whose business is it? He said, you have one thing and one thing only to concern yourself with, and that's recovery from the disease of alcoholism in the program and fellowship Alcoholics Anonymous. And he says, I'll make you a promise that if you put as much time and energy into AA as you used to put into trying to stay loaded and run the universe, that all these unresolved problems are going to take care of themselves. And inside me, I guess I just gave up. And that was my moment of commitment. And I said to myself, okay, all right, if I don't do anything the rest of my life except come to these stupid meetings and play hearts in the back of the club with these old men, if that's all I ever do, if I don't have to sober up again, if I don't have to wake up sometime in my own urine. Ted was talking about throwing up. I know what it's like to throw up. I used to come to every morning, middle of the night, whenever I'd come to, and I'd be sick and I'd need a drink real bad. And one time, I know that I have a little bit of wine left in this bottle. And I know it's just enough to get me well if I don't throw up. And I don't have any money, but if I can get the wine down, I can go out in the street and hustle some money and get another bottle. And I got to get this bit of wine down, or else I'm in a lot of trouble. And I took a hit off it, and I'm determined I'm not going to throw up. And I clenched my teeth, and it came out my nose. And I've been eating. I guess I ate chili somewhere the night before. I almost found God. And I don't want to live like that no more. I didn't want to see that look in people's faces when you're out there panhandling nickels and dimes on the street, that look of disgust and pity. I don't want to see that no more. And I didn't have the courage to kill myself. So I made a commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous. And the Buddhists have a saying that's a couple thousand years old. It says that when the student's ready, the teachers appear. And from that moment on, I've been falling into the hands of people in Alcoholics Anonymous that have turned my life around. I was real lucky to have fallen into the hands of people when I was new, my sponsor and the members of my home group, of people who believed in the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous, the steps as they're outlined in the book, and they believed in a lot of service. And they got me, they started pushing me into going on 12-step calls when I was brand new. I would go with my people at the club, and I went with my sponsor a couple times, and they had me become a secretary of a meeting when I was only a few months sober. And I just kept saying yes to Alcoholics Anonymous. And when they told me to hit my knees in the morning and ask God for help, I just did it. I didn't really believe that there was a God, but I just did it. And as time went on, I started to feel like I was a part of you. And the meeting I was secretarying, it was becoming my meeting, right? And after I was sober about a little over a year, in 1 week, I had two guys ask me to sponsor them. And I couldn't believe it. And I started thinking, wow, if two people a week asked me to sponsor them, I better get myself a house with a big yard near a ballpark and some goats. Because I'm ready. And I got a little crazy. I went through a phase in Alcoholics Anonymous that a lot of us go through, where I wasn't carrying the message, I was carrying the disease. And I was trying to find people jobs, and I was saying all this other kind of stuff. And I think, looking back, maybe I hurt some people. Because I was trying to get between them and their pain. Instead of just giving them the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was trying to fix them. Years ago, I have a friend who's a Budweiser salesman, and he told me he used to go down every year to Peru. And he told me this folk story that came from Peru. And it was about a farmer who he grew up being enchanted with these butterflies that they have down in Peru. They're big, blue, luminescent butterflies. And he always was infatuated with them. And one day he found one of their cocoons at the edge of his property. And he went down there every day and he would just sit there and radiate all this enthusiasm and love towards this butterfly that was going to come out of the cocoon. And one day he watched it start to struggle to try to break out, and he watched it struggle and struggle, and days went by and it still couldn't break out. And he became afraid, and he took his knife and very gently he slit the side of the cocoon. And the butterfly wiggled its way out and fell to the ground. And its wings were underformed and it died because it hadn't struggled enough. And what I started to realize in Alcoholics Anonymous is that my very life depends upon me trying to help you and me trying to care about you, but not me trying to fix you. That for me to be relieved of the bondage of self, I have to show up and do service and sponsor guys and go to hospital and institutions and all that stuff. Not to become wonderful, but because if I don't do that, I once again fill up with me so much that there's no room in my life for God's grace. See, I think in 1971, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, God's grace was there waiting for me. The problem is I was so full of me that there wasn't any room for anything else. And you guys, through your actions and example, have taught me the secret of how to get out of me and find the freedom. I'm going to talk about one thing, and I'm going to tell you about a guy that was real important in my life, and I'm going to shut up. After my dad died when I was 5 years sober, and after a couple years, my mom met a guy I got sober with. We both got sober the same year. His name was George. And George was a cantankerous old guy, and they started living together in sin. And I loved George. George went to a lot of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. He used to volunteer at a Skid Row halfway house on the west side, over in the middle of the ghetto in Vegas. And my home group takes a meeting in there. And every week I'd see George over there. And George got cancer. And it was terminal. And he went through the chemotherapy. And the one thing George was very proud of is he had beautiful white hair. And he lost all the hair. And I was with him the day his hair fell out. And he was so upset and he cried. And what he did is he went out and he bought a cap. And he put the cap on and he showed up at the rehab that night to try to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to those people over there. And I saw George go through. I saw George show up at meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and talk to newcomers when he should have been in a hospital, when he was in so much pain he really shouldn't have been doing anything except being in a hospital bed. And I was with George when he died a little over a year ago. And I miss him. And he was one of my heroes in Alcoholics Anonymous. He believed in a principle that was taught to me by my sponsor that I see in this group, that what we do is more important than what we feel. And George died with an incredible amount of dignity. And he died caring about someone other than himself. And I know in my heart that George died free. He died free of the only thing a guy like me ever has to worry about being free of. And that's the bondage of self. Because when I care about you, that hole I've been trying to fill up all my life gets full. And when I think of me, it gets big again. And if you don't believe that, if you're sitting here and you're at a stage and you're 4 or 5 years sober and you think the AA, the answer really is therapy or something like that, I'll put it to a test. Spend the next week doing nothing except thinking about and working on you. Okay? Now, if you survive this week, spend a week doing nothing except trying to help somebody else. And if you've got the same disease that I got, you'll know what the answer is. And if you're new, I got good news and bad news. The good news is that Alcoholics Anonymous is an effective treatment for the inside emptiness of alcoholism. The bad news is that it doesn't work as fast as five shots of tequila. Thank you.